1947, and this interview is one of a series concerning black history in Louisville, Kentucky. And I wonder if we could begin, Ms. Butler, with getting some biographical information from you, where you were born, raised, education, and how you got started with math.
Okay. I was born in Louisville in 1912, and I had my early education, elementary and secondary, in Louisville. I attended college at Hampton Institute in Virginia, and some years later I attended the University of Michigan Graduate School, and I took some actuarial work. I began my employment with Mammoth 1939, and I was employed at that time as a clerk at the district office in Louisville. I came to the home office in 1940, working as a clerk in what we called the agency accounting department. And some years later, I became office manager and assistant secretary. And I really don't know when I was elected secretary, but it was probably in the late 50s. Or maybe the early 60s. I'm not too good at remembering dates. And that's about my history.
What is your relationship in the structure of the organization? Is it president, and then right now it's your position?
President and vice presidents. I'm one of three vice presidents. Mm-hmm. I'm also the secretary.
What field do you have?
Well, of course, as secretary, I have control of all the records. I'm in charge of corporate correspondence with stockholders, insurance departments, the public, what have you. Internally, I supervise the claims division. I supervise underwriting and policy issue, printing and supply department, and I also supervise the clerical workers in the actuarial department.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of where you got started.
That's where I started.
Sure. We talked a little bit yesterday with Mr. Price, and I wonder if we could talk with you a little bit about the history of Mammoth Life and what you remember. And if we can just begin with how it originated, how Mammoth Life got started.
As I was told, Mammoth was conceived in the minds of two young men. One was my father, and the other was a man named W.H. Wright, who was from Alabama.
Who was your father's name?
H.E. Hall, Henry E. Hall.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And he and Mr. Wright met in Louisville, because they both came to Louisville in the early part of the century. My father had worked for an insurance company in the western part of the state, around Henderson, Owensboro, and small towns in that area. And that insurance company left the state. I don't know whether their license was taken up. I really don't know the details. But he saw many people who lost their insurance protection. And he determined that if he could, he was going to try to organize a company which would protect them. And he and Mr. Wright worked together for several years. I believe they applied to the Department of Insurance for a license to do business about 1910. And while their application was pending, the Kentucky legislature changed the law and made the requirements for starting an insurance company steeper. They were not able to qualify. So,
was there any hint that they were making these steeper requirements because a black institution was trying to get started?
Yes, that was the reason for the new law, was to stop the black organization. And the impetus behind the law was started by white insurance companies, which were then operating in the state of Kentucky. And I suppose they were profiting from their business on black people, because at that time, premium rates were different for blacks and whites. And so there was more profit in for the company in the black business.
There's a higher, what is the terminology?
Higher loading.
Yeah.
They also used higher mortality rates, and that's the way it was. So at any rate,
I know. I hate to interrupt you again, but this is about the same time, I believe, that the segregation laws were being passed.
That's about the same time. At any rate, Mr. Wright, and my father went to court, and of course the case dragged on and on and on for a number of years, and it was not until 1915 that the appeals court in Kentucky granted Mammoth a license to do business. And that was, I think, in July the 12th. And
1915.
And by that time, there was an organization of people. Now, this is sort of sub rosa, but there was an organization of people really working behind the scenes throughout Kentucky, just gathering names of people who were willing to take insurance with Mammoth. And when the court decided that Mammoth could do business, I think they sent out a telegram to these workers throughout Kentucky, and all it said was go. That means now you can put it on paper. And that's the way Mammoth started. Mammoth operated as a mutual company until 1924, I guess, and then they decided to change into a stock company. And stock was sold just like you sell insurance policies, many of it with a dollar down and a dollar a week until you get a share paid for. But I guess that thousands of people throughout Kentucky purchased Mammoth stock. And we've just been struggling and going on from then until now.
What was the setup for the mutual going back? How did that work?
Well, you know, a mutual company theoretically is owned by the policyholders. And each policyholder is a part owner of the company. And theoretically, the policyholders share the profits made by the company in the form of dividends. Uh-huh. And I don't know, as I have looked back over the history, I don't see any records which show that during those first years, the policyholders received any dividends, but I don't believe they did. That's just, I'm thinking about that now. Of course, at that time in 1915, I was 3 years old, so I really didn't know too much of what was happening. All I knew was that I had a father who came home in the afternoon and ate dinner, and then he went out again. I don't know when he came back. And in the morning when I got up, he was there for a few minutes, ate his breakfast, and he was gone again. And my mother was really the one that held the family together, because he just didn't have time. I don't think at that time I realized what he was doing. In fact, I know I didn't. All I knew was that he came and he went. But I learned later to appreciate what he was doing, to appreciate him much much more than I did at the time. I can remember the time when I was ashamed to say who I was, because I just didn't know my father. I didn't know what he was doing. Although even as a youngster, 9, 10, and 12, I visited the Mammoth office, which was then located at 422 South 6th Street, the site of the state office building. And I visited the office on occasions when I went to town, but you know, it was just a place to me, a place to go and enjoy adult company for 15 or 20 minutes and talk to the girls who worked there, and it was just a vacation or a spree. Then I guess I really didn't appreciate what was happening until I left home. And
you went to school,
college? I went to school when I went to college. I, well, the regularity of the checks made me know that somebody is thinking about me. And my father wrote me once a month. And his letters were always, they weren't always encouraging. But he always had something to say to help me. At that time, Virginia was a long way from Kentucky. And we didn't get to come home for Christmas or Thanksgiving or Easter. You went in September and you came back in June. And you didn't pick up a telephone and make a long distance call. You wrote letters. That's an art that children don't know now. They pick up the phone and talk for an hour. So Daddy's letters were always good to receive because he had a knack of writing things that would stay with you. Whatever my problem was at school, he could always offer me some suggestion for solving it. He never did tell me what to do, but he would quote something or send me a book. I can remember feeling quite insecure at school. And Daddy sent me a book called Self-Confidence and How to Develop It. And then he sent me another book, Timidity and How to Overcome It. And his letters were full of words of wisdom, how to get along with other people. And then I began to really appreciate him as an individual. And I learned later to, I just became very, very close to him from then on.
When you went away to school, was Hampton just one of the only places available for someone from Kentucky to get a college education?
Well,
I didn't know
at
the
time,
was in effect then.
Yeah, oh yes, the day law was in effect. And there was Kentucky State College at Frankfort. That was the only place you could really get a college education in Kentucky that I know of. I don't believe Western can, no. I think that was the only place, because later, of course, the University of Louisville opened a school called Louisville Municipal College, but that was after I had gone to college, so it wasn't available. And I think Hampton was selected because I had two choices: Kentucky State or Frankfort. And I mean Kentucky State at Frankfort or Hampton. And Hampton was the other alternative, because Hampton was my father's alma mater.
Oh.
And you just didn't, that was it. He was sold on Hampton, and that's where you go. If you don't want to go to Hampton, you can go to Kentucky State. That was just the way it was. And I chose to go to Hampton. I'm very glad that I did. I don't regret it at all.
Well, what kind of programs did Hampton have at that time?
At that time, Hampton had the School of Education, which trained you to teach in the elementary or secondary level. They had a School of Music, School of Home Economics, a trade school for boys and young men where they taught auto mechanics, electricity, printing, it's all kinds of trades. Oh, and there was the School of Agriculture. That was big. Hampton was a good place to go because there were five boys to every girl. So you're gonna have a good time. And it was nice. I enjoyed every minute of the 4 years I spent at Hampton. But I learned to be a teacher.
Is that what you went into education?
Yep. I wasn't musical.
Neither am I.
So I was in the School of Education. My majors were mathematics and science. And when I left Hampton, I taught in a two-room school in Virginia for a year. And then I...
All grades or elementary or...?
A two-room school. Grades 1, 2, and 3 were in one room. Grades 4, 5, 6, and 7 were in another room. At that time, Virginia only had 11 years of education, public education, for Negro children. And all Negro children you had first through the 7th, and then 4 years of high school. But there were not 12 grades as there are now, and they were later. So I taught from the 5th through the 7th grades. And then the next year I went to another county and I taught mathematics and history in a high school. What they called consolidated high school. All the Negroes in the county went to one high school. And, you know, we talk about busing now, but they were bused from one, I mean, if you were black, and white too, because actually there were not enough people in the county, even white students, to have more than maybe two high schools or in the county. And children were bused from one end of the county to another. It's just lately that busing has become a bad word. But busing has been around for a long, long time. And no, there was no hue and cry. I guess it's a matter of, no, it isn't even that. I was thinking it was a matter of putting white and black children on the same bus, but they don't even do that. So I don't know what it is. Anyhow, that's the way it was then. I taught there for 2 years, and then I married. Came back home after a year or two. Finally, I went to work at Mama. Mm-hmm.
Do you have to?
No.
Okay. You said you went to graduate school, I think, at Michigan?
In Michigan, uh-huh.
What prompted you to go up there? The day law was still in effect, I gather?
Oh, no. I had been working here. I didn't go to Michigan until,
actually,
I think, I had been working. I believe I went to Michigan in 1947. I wanted to become an actuary. And that's an experience. I went to University of Michigan. I'd been out of school 15 or 16 years. So when I went to graduate school, it was a little difficult to get back into study habits, but I wanted to become an actuary. And I don't know whether this is a part of the history of Mammoth. I don't know how this reflects on Kentucky, but I think it has some bearing. The head of the mathematics department called me into his office.
In Michigan,
at the University of Michigan. He called me into his office to advise me that I was pursuing the wrong course of study, that actuaries had an organization which was very close, and that Negroes could not become members. And in order to become an actuary, you had to be a member of this society. And since I could not become a member of the society, it was useless for me to pursue this course. And he suggested that if I wanted to stay in mathematics, either go into pure mathematics and become a professor or go into accounting. And I assured my department head that I was not interested in a title. I was interested in obtaining information. And I preferred to stay there and learn something about actuarial science as much as I could. And whether I became a member of the Society of Actuary just didn't matter. And he told me that I wouldn't be able to get a job. And I told him that I wasn't concerned about getting a job. I had a job at the time, and I thought I would go back to the job. Interesting enough, I found out after that interview that this department head talked to the other Negroes who were then taking actuarial science. And there were two girls and one other young man at the time that I was there, Negroes. All pursuing actuarial science. The two girls, after their interview, one went into mathematics. One changed her course to accounting. The young man talked to me and told me about his interview, and I told him, yes, I had the same interview. He asked my advice, I guess because I was older and he was young, and I told him that he was needed. And I said, I told him about Mammoth, about other Negro insurance companies. I told him about the Atlanta Life, North Carolina Mutual. I told him about Universal. And I told him that at that time, I said, you know, I said, we are all at the mercy of white actuaries, except North Carolina Mutual. I said, Asa Spaulding has been to Michigan. I don't know whether he's a member of the Actuarial Society, but I know he has the information. And I told him, I said, if you will stay in this actuarial course, I can guarantee you'll get a job. And I gave him the names of several companies, persons to whom he should write. And I don't know, he is presently the president of Atlanta Life. And we are still very good friends.
What's his name?
Hill. Oh boy! Why would you ask me someone's name? You know, when you get my age, you forget names.
I do the same thing.
I can't think of his first name, but his last name is Hill.
Yeah, that's good enough. That's
mm-hmm.
good enough.
Yeah. So, here I am.
Well, did you ever join the Actuarial Society?
No. As a matter of fact, I did not complete my course. I was at University of Michigan 1 year. And then I had to come home. I had a sister who became seriously ill. She was an invalid, and I didn't have to. I chose to come home and stay with her rather than go back. I would have had to gone back because I was a little rusty. And when I went to Michigan, I dropped a graduate course and went back to take undergraduate calculus. Because I needed it, and which meant that I needed at least another 6 months in school, but I didn't go back. So I'm not qualified as an actuary. I just have a smattering of knowledge.
You know, does the same rules apply for this whatever the Actuarial Society was today as they did?
No, not anymore.
Not anymore. That's an interesting story. Getting back to Mammoth a little bit, Who actually were the people who backed the origin? Was it just going door to door to the...
Just door to door, knocking on doors and telling the story. I learned that the nights my father was out, he was finding people where they were, which means that he was going into barbershops and pool rooms and cafeterias and whatever. And that's where he was at night. Interesting enough, I don't know, you don't want all this, but my mother understood. And but she had friends who didn't. And that, so they tried to advise her about what she should do because my father was out every night. And I heard her tell a very good friend and neighbor one time that you take care of your husband and I'll take care of mine.
That's very understanding,
yeah.
Mother.
Yes, I really did. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Mammoth went from a mutual to a stock company. Some insurance companies invest in buildings to make money. Does Mammoth do that type of thing? Let mortgages for homes, churches, buildings in Louisville?
Uh-huh. Mammoth has given mortgages for churches in Louisville and outside of Louisville. We now operate in 8 states, and I guess there are several churches in all of the states who at one time or another had a mortgage with Mammoth. Mammoth has invested in home mortgages for a number of years. Mammoth helped, I don't know whether you are familiar with the western part of Louisville. I'm sure you don't remember when the homes on the parkway from Greenwood.
Which part?
South, Western Parkway.
Western Parkway.
Is that what you call it, Western Parkway? Yeah, from Greenwood South were built. But there was a development there. This must have been in the early 40s, the 30s. You weren't around. I'm sure you weren't around. And Mammoth financed those homes. The architect and contractor who built them was Plato. And they were built when FHA began, or during the early days of FHA, and Mammoth gave mortgages down there. That Mammoth was famous for block breaking. You know what that is?
No.
You know.
Yeah.
If a Negro wanted to buy a house in a formerly all-white neighborhood, you just couldn't get financing anywhere.
And from the white mortgage.
From the white mortgage companies, from building and loans or banks or insurance companies, nowhere would give you a mortgage. And Mammoth would give the first mortgage and break the block, and then all the other financial institutions would fall right in, and then when a block is broken, it's broken, and that's all. Mammoth did that in Louisville, Dayton, Cleveland, St. Louis, Cincinnati, oh, you name the city in these 8 states, and it has happened, mm-hmm. even in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So
there was a demand for housing in the black community. Mm-hmm. There was no other way.
No other way
to get financing
except through a black financial institution. And of course Mammoth wasn't the only black company that did it. They all did it. That was one way of helping. My father used to say, and I heard him say many times, that I'm almost through.
No, that's okay. I've got
another
side.
He wanted to build a company which would give employment to black boys and girls. We didn't use the word black then,
yeah.
But that was his sales talk to people. We're going to build an institution that will employ your children. And I guess one of my greatest satisfactions that I get out of being here at Mammoth now is seeing young people come in and learn and stay and rise to the high jobs. I got a lot of people that I call my children. Mm-hmm. And
let me interrupt you here and flip this over. We're just about out, and I don't want to miss. Okay, we're starting again here on side two. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, that's okay. We have home office employees, people who come in at a very low level, and they come out of high school. They aren't ready for a job, but they stay here. They complain that the pay is low, but so many of the young women and older women now, I mean they're mature women now, who have positions in industry and with the government today, started at Mammoth. And every time I see them, I feel so good. I really don't know what to do. I could almost reel off the names of many, many girls who started at Mammoth and who now have really representative jobs. They may not have made a lot of money when they came to Mammoth, but they learned something. They got experience, and they are now making money. And that makes me feel good. And then I see people here who came in like I did at the bottom, and they go right up to the top. My assistant, as a matter of fact, came in fresh from high school, knowing nothing except how to smile prettily. But she has been a wonderful worker. She's been here now, I don't know, I guess about 20 years. And she is studious. You know, there are courses in insurance that are offered not by correspondence, but there is an organization called Life Office Management Association. And we offer the courses here to employees who want to take them. And if they cost a little bit, something like, I don't know what the current cost is. A few years ago, it was about $20 for a course. And there are 8 courses altogether. And the company pays the cost for the course. If the employee passes. If the employee doesn't pass, then they must reimburse the company if they pass the examination. And I think we have about 25 young men and young women now who are preparing to take their test next week, the first week in May, and hopefully they'll all pass. There are, as I said, 8 courses. I think we have some girls who are taking course 6 now. We have 2, I think, taking 6. Oh, we have about 10 in course 1. They are just beginning. So it's wonderful.
How many employees do you have here, ma'am?
Here in the home office? Around 50, I guess. I really don't know.
And how many?
Altogether. Between 275, I guess, and 300, somewhere in that range. I don't know.
That's
exactly.
An 8-state area? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Our agents, too, are offered opportunities to go to school. There are courses called LUTC, Life Underwriting Training Course. They are encouraged to take that, and the company pays for it if they pass. There are other students, other workers who are taking, what do they call it? Courses which lead to the CLU designation, which you know is similar to a PhD in education. And after passing a course in CLU, the company reimburses the employee for his fees, and that's good.
I wonder if I could put you on the spot again, and you mentioned there were some people who started in Mammoth and have gone elsewhere. I wonder if you could perhaps on the tape mention some, just a few of the people Maybe you work in government or other industry?
I don't know. I put people on the spot. I don't know whether they want, whether they are.
Okay.
Or, you know, I'd really not like to call anybody else's name because I don't know how they feel about it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I understand. That's no problem. Uh-huh. What do you look for in the future in Mammoth?
The future of Mammoth, well, what do I look forward to? I look forward to Mammoth's continued growth, economically, all black businesses are having a hard financial time. Mammoth has struggled before. There are fewer black insurance companies in operation today than there were 10, 15, 20 years ago. I believe that the number will shrink further within the next 15 or 20 years. Hopefully, it is my hope that Mammoth will be one of the survivors. I think the organizers, the founders of Mammoth were dedicated. They weren't the only dedicated people in the world, I know. But I just love to visualize Mammoth as being one of the survivors, not as a black company, but as an American company, just any other organization, any other insurance company. I really would. We have no prejudice. We don't have the word race on any form that we have. Sometimes, and we know that we have white policyholders, because we have received claims, and maybe the hospital's form has race on it, and they indicate, that's the only indication we know. And because it really doesn't matter to us. We have employees who are white, and they get along with us, and we get along with them. We get along with them. I don't know how they get along when they leave, but they stay.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. You mentioned that the market seems to be shrinking for black insurance companies. Mm-hmm. Do you know what reasons are the larger insurance companies really applying pressure or making inroads into your customers? Do you have any way to combat that? Or
the larger companies make inroads on our customers, on our employees. They can lure our employees away with promises of higher rates, higher pay, higher commissions. Pardon me. Fortunately, some of the employees come back. They try it for a while, and then they come back. They also have entered the market. They found that the old myth about blacks dying quicker really doesn't pan out that way. So they have found that black insurance is still as profitable as any other, and it is against the law for them to discriminate in their rates, although some companies have subtle ways. We won't discuss that.
Okay.
But some.
I was just going to ask you.
They have maybe as an example, they have red rates and green rates, and some people qualify for red and some qualify for green.
Hmm. Booklet that they read.
Uh-huh. And there's no mention in their printed material of race, but I guess they know how to get it across. If you live west of a line, you know how they give you the weather report. if you live,
yeah.
There's a tornado warning for communities west of a line running from here to there. Well, that's the way they designate it. If you live west of a line running from the river to the fairgrounds, you use green rates. Otherwise, you use red rates.
And even if the customer's looking over the guy's shoulder while he's looking at the different ages.
Yeah. But that's all the customer sees,
yeah.
is wherever he opens his book. You know, he just uses the green pages,
right.
or the green, where the green tab is. That's the way it's done sometimes.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you hope to expand Mammoth's customers, perhaps from, I guess, mostly black
yes,
by hiring the white insurance, more white
that's,
insurance?
That's one that thing, one? That's one of the ways that we believe we can begin. If we have...
I don't mean to be white. Taking any trade secrets away.
No, that's no trade secret.
Okay.
If it's difficult for a black salesman to canvass a white area. It's difficult to get prospects in a white area. It's difficult to get a client to sign on the line. Oh, you have a few, just as we have a few whites who are insured, but it is a minority. So the best way is to employ white agents, and we have some. But we don't know what color their business is. Hopefully, hopefully it's mixed. We don't know. And we don't know where people live in Kansas City or Milwaukee or even Detroit. We don't know where the line is.
Right. I know your deal mainly in life and health insurance.
That's right.
Has there been any thought to branch out into other areas of insurance business?
There has been talk about going into the fire field several years ago. And although we haven't ventured there because we haven't licked the life and the health yet, we still have that in the back of our minds. I wouldn't say definite plans as far as timing is concerned, but certainly in the minds of the younger people who are coming along, they are planning to expand our product and our lines of work. That's the only way we could survive anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's good. I'd like to give you some time to see if you have any general comments you would like to make regarding the relationship between Louisville and Mammoth today and in the past. Just open it up for any general discussion. Put you on the spot again.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. The relationship between Louisville and Mammoth, I don't know. Mammoth, I think, in the business community of Louisville, has a. Well, let me say it this way. Mammoth is well thought of, generally, among the people who are out front in the financial world. I think that Mammoth offices are respected. I think that Mammoth is becoming an integral part of what makes Louisville run, I think Mammoth should, not only because it represents the people in some sort of way, but I think that the city is fast. It's getting to the place now where it's close to 50-50. I remember when I went to school at Hampton, I think the percentage of Negroes in Louisville was something like 16 or 15 or something like that, but I know it's the percentage has changed quite a bit now. And
I think Lewis Coleman of the Urban League said it's around 24%.
24%.
Well, I may have misquoted him. Uh-huh, much.
So I think that Mammoth represents possibilities. I think it represents a hope for younger people. It's a symbol of achievement in a way that it gives the poor, it gives the ordinary, not the poor, it gives the black children something to look forward to, something, well, this did succeed, you know. Heck, you can't clobber a child to death by seeing failures, because all he sees is closed stores, drug stores, grocery stores, all down the line. This used to be a grocery, but now it's all boarded up. This was a theater, but now it's all boarded up. And other black businesses just don't last. And you have to have a symbol of success in order to want to succeed. You've got to have something to look forward to. And it's my hope that Mammoth will be that symbol. With the help of all the people in the city of Louisville and God, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Would you like to say anything else, or?
Well, I tell you, I think I've said a lot.
Okay, I know this can wear you out, the interview.
It doesn't. Most of what I've said is enjoyable because it comes from. It's real. I mean, I'm not putting on.
I understand.
I'm just saying the things. I really didn't talk much about the history of Mammoth, did I? I talked a bit more about
yes.
the history of.
Well, you are part of the history of Mammoth, so that's what we need. Well, thank you. I think that concludes the interview. Let me
you're quite welcome.
Flip it off here. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Well, I'm back on again. We just thought of something else that we should probably include in that tape here.
Well, I was just saying that the building at 608 West Walnut is interesting. It has an interesting history. It was completed in 1926 and owned by Mammoth. At that time, the first floor consisted of a theater, the Lyric Theater, a drugstore, which was owned by a Dr. White who came here from Owensboro. And by the way, Dr. White was the uncle of Frankie Moorman, who had a filling station at 8th and Walnut for a long, long time. Then what else was on the first floor? Oh, there was the drugstore, the theater. I guess that's all. The second floor was consisted of the Mammoth's home office. Well, I should say half of the second floor, because the other half was rented to the Urban League, had an office there. And the Supreme Liberty Life Insurance Company had its district office on the east side of the second floor. And the third through the fifth floor consisted of apartments. There were six apartments on each floor. And the building stayed that way for quite a few years. Then as the company expanded, well, first we took over all of the second floor and we had to put out our very good tenants. And they had to find other locations. And then we moved to the third floor and we lost six good tenants. The next we just took the other floors. Just gradually, as we grew, we just needed the space. In 19, 65, I guess, was that when urban renewal began?
Around that time, right.
We were offered money for the building. The city wanted to buy the building, and, well, urban renewal was going to use it. But then they made us a very lucrative offer. They offered to relocate us in a used building, a building formerly occupied by another life insurance company. And we declined the offer. We decided to stay. So they told us that in order to be compatible with the area, there were certain improvements that we would have to make. And so the auditorium of the theater was demolished, and we put the new look on the outside. And that's all. Other than that, the building is just like it was.
It sounded like in 1929, that was when your father was still. Uh-huh. It sounded like somebody had it in mind to start with a small office, but room for expansion.
That was the idea. And you know, we had all types of resistance from the city authorities about remaining here, because the first
65?
Place, they told us that this building was an apartment building, and it was not suitable to be office space, but it was built that way. And we had to get the original plans to prove that the building is structurally sound. Every floor is reinforced concrete, and the walls, none of the walls are what they call bearing walls. It is supported by concrete columns. There's one sticking out there, right there, and you see them all through the building. Even where we have torn down the walls to make office space, these columns are support, and none of the walls are supported of the building. And of course, our plans for renovation had to be approved, and there were a number of minor faults found. I think the last time we submitted our plans, it came back, and the fault they found was that there was no outlet for water, for a water hose to be attached on the outside of the west side of the building. Now there was there's an attachment for, you know, a hose to
fire department or just regular.
To water your flowers and clean off your, a spigot. No spigot on the west side of the building. Some of the demands were really ridiculous. There was one at the front. There was a spigot at the front where you could attach the hose to wash off the sidewall. But there was none on the west side of the building. You need one over there. You'd be surprised.
That's amazing. Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad you thought of that. Detail. Well,
You know, this building was called the Gold Coast Apartments. It wasn't a mammoth building. When it was built, it was the Gold Coast Apartments. And in the black community, you were somebody if you lived in the Gold Coast. Yeah. Well, it's no longer the Gold Coast. It's now the Mammoth Building.
Mm-hmm. When did that change? Is that as you were expanding?
Oh, just as we were expanding and as tenants began to move out, the name just sort of dropped away. Mm-hmm. Just stopped using it. I don't know who named it the Gold Coast, but that was it. And there was a, and everybody clamored to get in the Gold Coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a few of them. Well, I think I've taken up quite a bit of your time, and I appreciate you talking with me, and I guess that will conclude our interview officially here.
Okay.
Thank you.